This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Transform Wisconsin is a statewide coalition that's been working for the past 18 months to create healthier places for people to live, work, and play. In western Wisconsin, five counties are working with the group to make improvements in the greater La Crosse area. A recently released regional survey shows that the vast majority of area adults are concerned with two particular public health problems, childhood obesity and youth tobacco use. La Crosse County Extension Director Mary Meehan Stroob discussed the survey results with Paula Silla, co-coordinator of the La Crosse Healthy Living Collaboration, and Autumn Grooms, project coordinator of Monroe County's Schools on the Go.
In Monroe County, one of the things that was particularly interesting to us was that residents agree that youth tobacco use and child obesity are serious problems, which is important to our grant, which is a food systems impact grant. Of those, 91% of Monroe County voters surveyed think that childhood obesity is a serious problem in Wisconsin, and 36% said that it's very serious. And this is important to the work that we've been doing, we're focusing on healthier eating habits through farm to school.
Were the results different in each county?
I think the percentages were probably a little different in counties, but the overwhelmingly, I think the positive message here is that people in this part of Wisconsin, as well as really across all of Wisconsin, are supportive of creating environments that support healthy behaviors. They're concerned about these health behaviors that contribute to chronic disease, and they're looking at what can we do as citizens who live in these communities to make the environment healthier. People really care. It's on their radar screen that overweight children is a risk factor for chronic disease. It's on their radar screen that kids being inactive contributes to obesity. It's on their radar screen that tobacco use contributes to chronic disease as well. And so I think it was just reaffirming when we've been working in some of these lifestyle health-related areas that people are listening to the messages that we're giving and the things we're trying to do, and there's not a lot of resistance. There is, yeah, tell us more. Help us create a healthier environment.
So what is the rate of childhood obesity and teenage smoking in the counties that identified those as the major problems?
I think the general rate is that one out of three children is overweight or obese.
Okay.
And the smoking rates, I think it's about between 10 and 13% of the population, which is down from what it was a number of years ago. But it still is an important factor and a contributing factor to chronic disease and lifestyle illness later on in life.
And would the same be true in Monroe County then?
It is true. And what was interesting to add to what Paula had said, is there wasn't a lot of variation between male and female in the polling results. These are concerns that stretch across gender lines, that people are concerned about the health of children and youth smoking and tobacco-free locations for residents to have.
You talk about the results in terms of childhood obesity and teenage smoking. Did you have results in terms of adults, or were they specifically looking in terms of our youth today and then extrapolating what that could mean into the future?
I think the polling data really looked at the adults' perception of the health of children.
Okay.
And that they're concerned about tobacco use among kids. They're concerned about obesity. They're concerned about environments that may or may not be open to kids to be physically active away from the school day or even during the school day. Some of the things that we're seeing or we're incorporating with this community transformation grant are active schools, where we look at, it seems almost silly to be talking about minutes of physical activity at recess, but teaching kids how to play games in the playground so that they're physically active during recess, that's what recess is about, isn't it? And maybe it was when we were kids. You know, I listened to the staff who are working with the school educators and the kinds of strategies that they're incorporating, and I'm thinking, wow, you have to really encourage kids to be physically active at recess or physically active in the classroom. I understand the importance of taking a break and burning off some energy so that you can pay attention in the classroom, but having active lessons as a part of your classroom as well, it's all it's stuff that you know works, but it's being done in, I think, very deliberate ways and very evidence-based ways that really show a connection to learning and show a connection to health. So
do the findings from this poll, do they match the kinds of problems that you found in your counties that you've been working on as well?
I think they really show a lot of the work that's been done in the first year of these Transform Wisconsin grants. I know a lot of the food-related questions and childhood obesity questions highlight some of the work that's been done in Monroe County in regards to farm to school. We've been working a lot to improve access to fresh fruits and vegetables, and by integrating some of the local items on the school lunch lines, that's showing kids and their families how to find maybe fresh tomatoes, and we've incorporated school gardens, and that's improving recreational activities for families to work in the school gardens, and it's also bringing some of those fresh produce items in, and it's showing them how to garden at home. So some of the things that were highlighted here, it just exemplifies some of the work that's been done through these grants, and that'll be done further in the next year, and I'm assuming the same has been done in La Crosse County as well.
I think we also had the opportunity in La Crosse County with the Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant initiative that we received in 2010 that started some of the farm-to-school activities in La Crosse County schools. But the Community Transformation Grant and some other funding from the UW-Madison School of Medicine with the Harvest of the Month project in schools, which has expanded the farm-to-school reach, has continued to give that those activities wheels or keep them going, and also help us to look at sustainability when this project funding is over. How can we build it into the environment and the policies of the school so that they're looking for local sources of produce? The menuing of different produce that we're talking about, kale chips, and what a big hit kale chips were when they menu these items. So before they're served in the school lunches, they do taste testing where these kids have an opportunity to try a taste. I always called it at home a no thank you helping, where you try it, you don't have to have a whole plate full of it, but you try it. And if they try these things and then they're menued maybe the next week, and then they're menued some other time during the month, and it's grown locally, and maybe they've even grown it in their school garden, it's just that it emphasizes the connection to the environment and gets the kids excited about the food that they're growing that's grown locally. You had a great story that you told about a young man who didn't like tomatoes.
One of the big things that's happened with the program is we had school gardens that really took off this summer with the Transform Wisconsin money. We were able to put school gardens at a school in each of the districts. And a young man that attends school at Norwalk, Ontario, Wilton, had tried some fresh salsa that was made at the school using the tomatoes from the garden, and he tried the salsa and he really liked it, and he had gone home and told his mother how much he liked the salsa, and he wanted to then make salsa at home using the tomatoes from his garden. The only thing is this boy had never liked tomatoes before, would not eat tomatoes, and so his mother had emailed requesting the recipe for the salsa from the school. And we were able to get her that recipe, and they went on to make the salsa at home. And so we've created a recipe exchange on our website and social media sites where now people can get some of the recipes that we've been making at school to share with the families. And that's been really popular as a way to continue to help families make some healthier recipes. So that's been a benefit.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio, La Crosse. I'm Mary Mian Strube, and my guests today are Paula Silha, co-coordinator for the La Crosse Healthy Living Collaboration, and Autumn Grooms, project coordinator for the Monroe County Schools on the Go project. And we've been talking about the recently released Healthy Living Poll and what it says for the communities in western Wisconsin. Health departments have been fighting these kinds of issues for years. Teen smoking is an example of that. Do you think the results from the polls reflect reality?
Well, I surely hope they do. I mean, I hope that it's very encouraging to think that they do. I would hope they do, because it shows that the work we've been doing over the years in tobacco prevention and control make a difference. I think we wouldn't have a smoke-free workplace law if we hadn't been talking about the harmful effects of secondhand smoke. And I think what really was the tipping point for me is when we started talking about smoke-free environments and the youth prevention strategy that smoke-free environments are. I don't know that the science is enough yet to push our local elected officials to look at regulations on smoking in outdoor areas, but I surely think there's enough personal information and enough personal testimony from people who are impacted by it. I mean, I talk to people all the time who are impacted by that. So I think if we use tobacco as the example, certainly the polling shows that there is an interest in looking at outdoor smoking. Do we have the political will yet to do something about it? I don't know, but that doesn't mean that individual people, business owners or park organizers couldn't do it on their own. And so we'll see where we end up with that. I know it's something that the Monroe County Safe Communities Coalition has talked about for the last several months as well. And I know that festivals talk about it routinely when they're thinking about hosting their outdoor festivals and maybe having a food tent or a beer tent or whatever. Should there be smoking in that beer tent or food tent? The smoke-free workplace law allows them to set those guidelines for their event. It doesn't say they can't do it. It certainly says that they can. And I think with any of us, the realization that smoke-free areas are youth prevention strategies just helps to make it more meaningful. To me, that was really a big tipping point when we were talking about smoke-free restaurants back in the 1990s was, oh, there's a connection to kids not starting to smoke if you have smoke-free restaurants. Yeah, there is. And that's where we're looking at smoke-free multi-unit housing in the Transform Project in La Crosse County and also in Monroe County, is we're looking at environments that families and kids live in. We're not trying to legislate what you can and cannot do in your own home. We're looking at how what you do and don't do in your home impacts your neighbors. And I think the statistic that was really mind-boggling, really, to me, was to think about the air in any given apartment is recycled air. 60% of that air is recycled from neighboring apartments. I guess it makes sense. You can tell when someone's making tacos for dinner, you know, down the hall from where you live. If you're in an apartment building, I lived in apartment buildings or dorms, you can tell when someone was making popcorn down the hall, you know. So yeah, the air is exchanged or recycled. And you think about the secondhand smoke, it knows no boundaries. It can get through the light switches, you know, it can get through lots of small openings as well. And so if we think about smoke-free air and we think about the youth prevention strategy, it's really a given that we want to be thinking about the impact then on you know, preventing and helping people to quit, preventing people from using.
How does the health departments in both La Crosse and Monroe counties intend to use the information from this survey as you look to future programming?
We've been partnering a lot with the Monroe County Health Department, and we're looking at the data, and we've done some other activities, and we're looking as we move forward at making some decisions with what we'll be doing in the coming year, and we're going to be implementing more school gardens and looking at ways for WIC participants and senior services to become involved with possibly getting some food from the gardens and being able to access some things that way. And then we're also looking at policies that are in place, such as wellness policies in the school district and throughout the community. And with the help of the health department, we're going to be working on some of those things.
And I think that polling data really is something that we need to utilize to educate our decision makers that the public does care about this, and that it affirms, I think, the activities and the work that we're doing. I mean, we all get the pushback sometimes of, oh, the nanny state, you know, that's being promoted out there. But really, people do care. We sometimes only hear from the vocal minority. We don't hear from the majority. And I think this polling data shows that us that, you know, people care about the environment that they live in. We need to use this data and help to educate our legislators so that they have the will and the knowledge to say, yeah, you know, the people in Western Wisconsin do care about this. And it is important to, you know, put some support, maybe financial support, but maybe just the support of, we think these are good ideas and we encourage you to continue to look for funding to do that or to be present at some of the events that we pull together.
How long will it take before we'll see change in, say, childhood obesity?
It takes a couple years. I mean, it's just like with any of us. If I want to lose 5 pounds, it doesn't come off in a week. You know, it takes weeks, it takes months. But if we're looking at changing the environment in which we raise our kids, and we're looking at having it be something that is a positive thing, that is just the way we live now, and sustaining it, integrating it, so to speak, into the environment and into policies that are there, supporting it so that it's not just a blip of a change, it's going to take time. And I'm thinking it's going to take several years. Do I think it'll take a decade? I don't think it'll take that long, but it's going to take several years. And I think we want to ensure that what we're doing is very positive and very integrated into the way schools operate, so that they can continue to do it when the money is gone. And so, I mean, it's complicated to do, but we also didn't get to the point where we were having kids be less active just like that either. It was a gradual process, and now it's a gradual ramping up of that process. The same thing with smoking. You know, you can talk about it and talk about it and talk about it. It's got to be the right kind of message that hits the smoker to go, oh, maybe that's why.
Do the findings from the 5 counties in western Wisconsin differ from other parts of the state?
I can't say that there's a significant difference. You know, what I have seen in some of the major talking points, I mean, this one, nearly 8 out of 10 people in Wisconsin are willing to pay more for locally grown fruits and vegetables in our schools. I think the polling data really speaks to the idea, I think statewide, that we all care about this. I'm sure there are little nuances that but as I looked at the data, even from the 5 counties, it was a percentage point or 2 difference. It wasn't 10 or 20 percentage points. And so, and it didn't really matter if the populations were Republican or Democrat or male or female. And that was the other affirming thing to me as well. Sometimes, well, in the political environment that we've had in Wisconsin in the last couple of years, it's been so polarizing. But I think this data helped to say, in Wisconsin, we care about the health of our kids. We care about, you know, what kinds of food we're feeding our kids, and we care about the environments that they're growing up in.
As a result of this poll, is there any prevention money that this opens up or will open up for and make available to the projects that you're working with?
I don't know that there's any state money that's associated with that. I don't think there's any money going to obesity prevention in the state budget. I mean, I know that there is some money going into tobacco prevention and control in the state budget. But this money associated with the transformation grants, whether it be one focus area, food systems or active living or the smoke-free multi-unit housing issue, because some communities got money for all three and some communities got money for only one or two things. Mm-hmm. This is funding from the Centers for Disease Control and is no state-level funding at all. I think what this polling data does is it helps us to use this to educate our legislators to say, hey, Wisconsin is one of the, I think we're 48 out of 50 states for funding in public health. That's not a good thing. What is the money going to? Well, I guess we need to ask our legislators, you know, about that. It's going to other things in this state. And maybe if we can help our environmental, or help our families lead healthier lives, we can spend more money in, you know, in prevention using these monies to start. But I think we need to use this polling data to say, you know, this is important stuff. And our local residents need to also be telling their legislators that. It can't just be those of us who are working in the projects because they think we have a vested interest. So I would call to the audience and say, if you care about these kinds of things, let your legislator know. It doesn't need to be a 3-page letter. It can be a quick email that you send, that you heard these people talking about this, you know, these kinds of activities, and you think they're a good idea. We want the vocal or the non-vocal majority to weigh in on their feelings or their views about preventive health and public health and support for these kinds of activities.
Anything else that you'd like to add that I didn't draw out that you wanted to be sure was shared?
On the Transform Wisconsin website, there's a lot of information about various projects that are going on throughout the state. you can learn more about what's going on in Green Bay, what's going on locally. And there's some great initiatives that have been started that are absolutely fantastic. And they all focus on public health and reducing chronic disease.
Autumn Grooms is project coordinator of the Monroe County Schools on the Go program. Paula Silla is co-coordinator of the La Crosse Healthy Living Consortium. They spoke with Mary Meehan Stroop, director of UW La Crosse Extension for La Crosse County, about the results of a recent public health survey that found issues of child obesity and youth tobacco use topping the list of issues of concern to those who participated in the five-county Western Wisconsin survey, part of the Transform Wisconsin statewide initiative. Information about the Transform Wisconsin movement is available on our website, WPR.org/newsmakers. Coming up, Maureen McCollum talks with a UW La Crosse biologist who helps build realistic models of frogs that are being used to research the behavior of frogs in Central America. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, extended interviews, pictures, and related web links can all be found on our website at WPR.org/newsmakers. You can also weigh in with your comments or track us on Facebook. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Researchers studying wildlife cannot always get animals to do what they want. So increasingly, biologists are using robots or dummies to try and recreate and completely control animal behaviors. At UW La Crosse, Assistant Professor of Biology Barrett Klein helped create a robotic frog to study the mating habits of a tiny frog found primarily in Central America. He's here today to talk about the project that has been underway for a few years now. I'm wondering if you can first explain who the little Tungera frog is. I understand we're not going to find them anywhere here in this area.
Yeah, certainly. So these are Central South American frogs. The Tungera frog, onomatopoeic term, really would sound something like this in the wild, Tungera. And what you have are these male frogs that will call female frogs in typically ephemeral pools of water. So in theory, you could walk around during a rainstorm in muddy boots and create a little puddle, and male frogs would gravitate toward these ephemeral pools in order to avoid, presumably, predators. So you won't have fish in these ephemeral pools that would eat up their tadpoles. Rather, they can relatively safely call potential mates, females. And these females would hop out of the woodwork toward the ponds if they hear a frog call that is attractive to them. And so it may start out with a simple call, just a whine. Sounds something like, ew. And you might have another frog that would go, ew, ew, ew. And it might be a while before suddenly you'll hear a call that sounds something like, ew, or ew. And this is a more complex call. So the simple call, the whine, plus what's called a chuck or a few chucks afterwards, renders that simple call more complex. Now, the females are almost invariably attracted to the complex calls over the simple calls. But the big question for a while was, why not always start off with a complex call? Because you'll get the female. And more recent research has strongly suggested that the complex call with the chucks can attract predators and parasites in the form of a trachopsorosis fringe-lipped bat, which hones in on a male calling with a complex call, or these mosquito relatives, a family of fly, that can bring parasites and vector those parasites to an unsuspecting male.
Beyond these mating calls, the sounds that they make, there's a physical element to their mating call as well.
Absolutely. So if you watch one of these male mottled brownish frogs in the wild, what you see is the whole body cavity and the whole vocal sac that distends around the mouth area alternating in inflation. So inflation, deflation, and it alternates between the body and the vocal sac. So there's a lot more going on than potentially just the acoustic element of the call. In courtship, there could be visible or visual components, and there could be tactile components, touch components. So say, for example, if you're calling in water, as they do, the displacement of water by a vocal sac that distends could create a series of ripples. Does the female respond to those ripples? Also, you've got this high contrast vocal sac distending, a ridiculously large balloon in front of their face. Is there a visual component? And that's some of the things that Ryan Taylor in Salisbury University and Michael Ryan at University of Texas, Austin, were really interested in exploring, what's called multimodal signaling. What are our perceptual modalities? Well, we've got sight, we've got sound, we've got touch, we've got taste, we've got smell. So we can play around with at least one, and much more complicated, two, and potentially in the near future, three or more of these modalities simultaneously.
And the two of them have been studying the mating habits for the last few years, and they enlisted your help and another designer to help them study the mating habits of these Tungara frogs.
Now, Michael Ryan at UT Austin has been looking at the Tungara frog. He is the Tungara maestro for decades. Ryan Taylor joined his lab as a postdoc at UT Austin, and during that brief window of time that year, I got to meet Ryan, and I heard him give a talk, an excellent lecture, in which he was describing the use of an artificial, what I like to call a faux frog or a robo frog, squirrel frog. And this was his earlier research, and he had what he calls sort of a clunky plaster frog with a hand-pumped condom as vocal sac. And during his talk, he made it very clear that he would love to have a better version of this and potentially an automated version of this. So after his presentation, I approached him and said, I've made fake frogs before, and I've got a friend in New York City, Joey Stein, who works at Moe Inc. in Brooklyn, who his whole business is making interactive, educational, and entertaining displays for natural history museums and other museums. And so I told him that Joey could give him some advice and I could certainly help him out. And he said, you're hired.
I was going to say, you probably were the only person in that room who has previously made fake frogs.
Probably. Yeah. Probably. Yeah, I used to work at the American Museum of Natural History in exhibitions, and we worked on a Hall of Biodiversity. And before that, I worked at Chase Studio Incorporated in Missouri, a natural history display making studio in the woods.
I mean, going back, why was it that you were creating fake frogs? And I've seen, I mean, it seems like not only do you have a scientific background, but an artistic background. You've not only made model frogs, but some model insects as well.
Mm. Yeah, there are many reasons to make doppelgangers and dummies and fakes, faux animals. One is for educational purposes. One is for artistic purposes, and there are wondrous renditions of organisms, either animatronic or static, in both education and in art. There's a third realm of science where it can come in very handy, because believe it or not, a frog either in the wild or in a lab environment doesn't always behave as you might hope. And if you can control aspects of that behavior, if you can make it repeatable, standardized, predictable, then you can lay out an experiment where you can test under different treatment conditions how a female frog can respond to a fake male frog. And as long as that fake male frog is hitting on points that are biologically relevant, then you can say something potentially you can extrapolate to the field, to a natural state. So I brought what I love to do in art and education and natural history display making to science in a couple of forms, and this was one. This was one of my agendas for joining Ryan Taylor and Michael Ryan, working with Joey Stein to make something at least somewhat realistic to play with aesthetics and the role of aesthetics in biology.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Barrett Klein. He's a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of Biology who's helped design a robotic frog to help study mating habits. The robo-frog is what you've called it. You've actually brought a few with. Can you talk about what exactly it looks like and how exactly it works?
Sure. So I do what I consider the easy half of the job. Joey Stein at MOE Inc. does the electronic animatronic portion. What I do is I take what lessons I've learned in sculpting, in mold making, and casting, and I put together what I try to render as realistic a frog as I can. And that takes a few steps, at least the way I've done it. There are other ways that are simpler, where you can make a crude frog that can work, and in some situations has worked relatively well, depending on what questions you're addressing.
By crude, do you mean it may not look exactly like the frog?
Correct. Okay. And there are examples of frogs that are made out of wax or clay. And as long as they resemble sufficiently the frog to, say, a predator, you might be able to, as some scientists have done, examine the damage to that fake frog in the field and capture on cameras what potential predators are cueing into colors or behaviors. What I wanted to do was what I deemed a little bit more delicate or intricate, and that was conspecific communication, or communicating to a member of your species, namely a female, when you're a male calling to that female. So in order to do that, what I did initially was I took a herpetology museum specimen, a dead frog, and I made a rubber silicone mold of that frog.
And you brought it with you here.
Yeah, yeah. So these are pretty emaciated urethane casts that were pulled from the silicone mold. This I use only as an armature. And that is, if I've got the relative proportions down of the real organism, then I can sculpt around it. And that's where the sculpture work comes into play. And I'll make, say, a mix of urethane, sculpt epoxy, metal wire, Elmer's glue, a mixed media piece that looks like a body-inflated tungra frog.
And it's
without
incredible.
The feet.
Yeah, sure.
Okay? And so the next step is to take this sculpted body, this prototype of the frog, and make a two-part rubber silicone mold of that. And that means placing it in a bed of clay, pouring silicone over that. Once that cures, I can peel that off and then place another layer of silicone over the top and then eventually pull out that prototype so I have two halves to this silicone rubber mold of the body. Now, for the feet, I took feet and did a one-part mold of that so that I could cast it in a very different material, namely hot melt glue. So I've got these rubbery feet that can survive a lot of wear and tear. So the end product is a pretty durable little frog with flexible feet. Next step, drill a hole through the body from the anal region to the oral region. And once I've drilled out that cavity, I'll have a way for something to travel through that will ultimately serve as the vocal sac. Now this is a... I tried a few things. I tried condoms, they pop. I tried gray party balloons, work pretty well. In fact, here's one tied with dental floss at the end. But ultimately, Joey and I found that a catheter, and the balloon survives for, say, 3 months inside a human body, does pretty well in surviving repeated inflations and deflations. So take this catheter, paint it with automotive flexible paints and fabric paints, so it resembles somewhat when inflated a male real frog's vocal sac. Now I can insert that through the cavity of the body of the faux frog. Next step, attach feet, clean up all the cast, paint it with layers of acrylic and then oil, spray it so that it looks like it's in water and glistens a little bit. And for human perception more than frog perception make those eyes glisten gold and black.
They're incredibly realistic.
Ooh, I need to make a Mach 2 and 3 with Joey in which I want them to inflate alternately, body and vocal sac. I'd also like a future faux frog to interact with external stimuli like a female approaching that male. I think that would be ideal because then you can control and automate a male that resembles not only a static male or a calling male, but a male that might respond as it does naturally or remotely in a controlled fashion by us in a lab situation.
I'm wondering if you made a video that's on YouTube of the mating call of the Tungura frog. You gave us a great rendition earlier, but I'm wondering if we should just listen to a few seconds of this video that you made.
And everyone's mimicry of the Tungura frog is different.
So we just heard the sound of the Tungura frog, and you were kind of explaining the different sounds that the male makes. And if you see in the video, you see that the female is slowly approaching, almost with each croak.
Yeah, what you've witnessed is a male calling, but that's really a robotic male calling with a computer-synthesized call. So it's considered somewhat of an average, attractive male call. So it's not technically a true or actual male frog call. So you've got the synthetic visual, the synthetic but somewhat realistic and certainly convincing acoustic within a sound-resistant or sound-insulated chamber that's used by Ryan Taylor and others in Gamboa, Panama, in the canal zone of Panama, where we collaborate.
And this research has moved on from the laboratory, as you said, to into the jungles of Panama, correct? Well,
so it started with Ryan Taylor's work in temperate regions with the squirrella, the squirrel frog. There are precedents in robo-frogs. Peter Nerens and his lab has produced really beautiful kinetic dendrobatted dart poison frogs for daytime male-male interactions, and that's really beautiful work. What we've done here is we've looked at multimodal signaling at dusk or at night in frogs that are considered to be primarily, if not exclusively, courting by sound to see if multimodal signaling can play a role, if vision can play a role under such conditions. So yeah, we've taken it to the tropics, to Central America, to Panama, and the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute is based on Barrow, Colorado Island and in Gamboa on the mainland in the canal zone.
So why is it important to study the habits of this one frog? And as you talked about, you know, you found that the female is wooed by these different signals. It's not just
right.
The sounds that it makes, but everything else surrounding it.
So there are many reasons, many ways to answer that question. And while we are interested in evolution, ecology, and behavior, and not just in this very common mottled brown Tungura frog of Panama, but across organisms, we wanted to test whether we can generalize, if we can find patterns in nature with respect to multisensory or multimodal signaling, how to communicate effectively. And the ecology component comes into play when you've got different environments, when you've got, say, a single individual calling in a relative vacuum versus a mass, a crowd, a cacophony of frogs attempting to call and communicate, where you might have relevance ecologically, behaviorally, with humans, you could argue. So, for example, the cocktail effect. There might be 20 people in this room talking and talking and talking. And if one across the room happens to say Barrett or Robo-Frog, strangely, I can orient toward and distinguish that out of the cacophony. So this cocktail effect is a fascinating perceptual anomaly that may not be an anomaly And so to understand it better under somewhat natural or naturalistic conditions in this frog could be pretty telling. Then we can look at evolution. If what we can find to be true in one amphibian is true under certain conditions across a number of amphibians and beyond amphibia to other tetrapods, to other vertebrates, maybe we can look at patterns in nature and look at causes of certain evolutionary trajectories.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about how a UW-La Crosse assistant professor of biology, Barrett Klein, helped design a robotic frog to study mating habits. Do you think that this research, Barrett, could carry over into other frog species? And is it yet?
Would you believe that scientists are banging down my door to have robo-frogs made?
I would. I mean, I'm seeing them in front of you right now, and I kind of wish that I was doing this research.
Well, you're welcome to.
You.
There are few scientists who have been interested in including robotics, and this is actually becoming a really influential area, because if you're going to answer questions, but you're limited with respect to how you can manipulate a situation or an organism under natural or naturalistic conditions, can you relieve yourself of that limitation? One way to ask otherwise impossible, intractable questions with frogs or any animal, including humans, would be to make fake ones that are convincing enough in one or more modalities to elicit behaviors in other organisms of the same species. So with the frogs, if you're stuck asking certain questions, say, for example, you see a calling male and you see a frog approach that male, and it doesn't have to be the Tungara frog, it could be any sexual frog species, you might ask the question, was it the pitch of the call? Was it the intensity of the call? How loud is it, you know? Or is it how it situated itself? Is it the physical behavior of displacing the water by the vocal sac? What is it about that call? Well, you can conduct observational experiments in the field and take notes fastidiously and attempt to render conclusions, or come to conclusions with respect to the notes you've taken. But manipulation is the hallmark of experimental biology. And so if you can manipulate a situation in a controlled fashion, then you can better make a claim as to what factors are eliciting behaviors, say, in that female. So robots, if appropriately, wisely created and presented, can relieve you of certain constraints in experimental biology.
Do you see any research happening in this area with frogs and possibly creating prototypes for species up here?
Mark B. in Minneapolis, Minnesota, has a rip-roaring lab with frogs. And there's a lab in UW-Milwaukee that works beautifully with frogs. And I think both of them would like to introduce, and actually are in the process of introducing, some false frogs in order to test such questions.
Researchers across the country, around the world, have used other species. I read about robotic squirrels.
Yes.
Some robotic cockroaches, which may be
indeed
one of the favorites of yours. But are you familiar with some of the other studies and maybe the differences that those studies have made in using robotic animals?
When you create a sculpture or when you create a molded, casted work for an exhibit, with each problem, with each sample presents a new challenge. And so with these frogs, we had a whole set of potentially unique challenges. And when you enter a mammal or bird realm, you're going to face additional challenges. So the sage grouse cyborg or robot that has been produced by Gail Petroselli, and the cockroach work and the squirrel work and others, There's lizard work as well, face a number of hurdles that will be different but intriguing. How real do you have to render your robot? And that will vary. That will vary not only with respect to species and their visual or other modality constraints, but also the context within which they do make their calls or when they communicate, whether it be verbally, vocally, or whether it be with gesticulations, in the case largely of the sage grouse. So she has a train track with a bird that shuttles down that train track toward a bird, and with very simple motions can elicit male responses. And that's marvelous. I mean, that's really telling and marvelous. It goes beyond, say, static examples and models, and it goes beyond kinetics. Recently, there's a lab that's produced cyborg insects, so very large beetles that, due to some electronics that are feeding off of muscle contraction in the wings, you can actually direct flight in these beetles. So it's going in very bizarre and intriguing new directions.
And something like using robotic animals or insects or frogs in research, that's not ever going to be something that completely replaces natural observations out in the wild, correct?
No, we always need to go back to the organism. A robot is never a surrogate. A model is never a surrogate. All it is a tool that a scientist can use to try to standardize and try to examine a naturally occurring, biologically relevant behavior in order to better understand the behavior of that organism, ideally in the wild, in a natural state. So any bit of robotics should take the good scientist back to the field, back to observing the organisms in nature, in order to better understand and ground that those observations in the lab in the field.
Are creating these prototypes, is it costly? Is it something that it's so new that maybe more researchers aren't doing yet, or are there financial limitations to that?
It can be very inexpensive or, for many, prohibitively expensive, depending on what you'd like the outcome to be. Certain studies that I was mentioning earlier that fabricate wax or clay models, oh, that could be $20 or so to produce a frog. It could be even less. To create something like this that depends on a de novo, a unique and new controlling unit that controls the simultaneous computer robot integration, namely Joey Stein's work at MOE Inc., that is more expensive. Now, once you create the first, you can make it a lot less expensive. What I'd like to do with these frogs, rather than depend on catheter balloons or pneumatics, displacement of objects with air, what I'd like to do is a mechanical pushing, maybe of rubber or urethane, a squishy ball, so that you've got a realistic frog that just has a mechanical unit below it that will just displace a gel. That could be really inexpensive, potentially.
Do you want to keep working with robotic frogs, or would you like to venture off into other species or insects? Or
I would love to continue my wonderful collaborations with Ryan Taylor, Michael Ryan, Joey Stein in the marvelous world of herpetology, especially with amphibians. I'm an entomologist at heart, so I'll always return to especially the social hymenoptera, bees, wasps, ants. But yes, I would love to continue long-term prospects, not just with the Tungara frog, but with other frogs. And we have ideas in the works of working with some temperate frogs to answer questions that delve into evolution of signaling, as well as ecological constraints and issues, and behavior, because I'm a behaviorist.
Do you think right now is a very important time to be studying frogs?
Any work that involves frogs to make people aware of and appreciate this diverse group of amphibians is important in terms of inspiring people to beware and protect, to conserve, to preserve the amphibians that are alive today, because there are massive extinctions, especially at higher elevations, of frogs and other amphibians around the planet due to chytrid fungus and complications. So yes, I think any work that deals with nature can compel people toward biophilia, and any work specifically with frogs can excite people, inspire people to embrace frogs and be aware of the threats that are facing frogs.
Barrett Klein is an assistant professor of biology at UW-La Crosse. He, for the last few years, has worked on a research project helping to design a robotic frog that studies mating habits. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Our production team includes Maureen McCollum, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews, pictures, and related web links. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.